I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show. James Frey's bestseller of a couple of years ago, A Million Little Pieces, is a harrowing account of his life as an alcoholic, drug addict, careening towards complete self-destruction, and concludes with his time in rehab. The New Yorker called it electrifying. His latest memoir picks up when he's in jail and follows his attempts to stay straight and reconnect the pieces of his broken life after 10 years of recklessness. And the new memoir is called My Friend Leonard. It is published by Riverhead. And I'm very pleased to welcome James Frey back to my show. Hi.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be back.
One critic said that you come off as someone writing himself out of a panic attack.
I certainly write about a lot of panic attacks I've had. I've had a strange life, and as I write the books, I just try to be honest about it, whether it's good or bad or weird.
But you also seem to have developed an approach to the language and to the rules of grammar that is completely your own, and that is one of the things that creates that sensation.
Yeah, I mean, when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I didn't want to write like anybody else. I didn't want my books to look like or read like any other books. And so I figured out this style that is devoid of most standard punctuation and grammar.
No quotation marks.
No quotation marks. No dialogue attribution. I think it reads very, very quickly and much easier than a lot of other writing.
Well, since the dialogue is probably invented to some degree because you weren't walking around with a tape recorder, is that also a way of getting around the whole problem of fiction, nonfiction?
I mean, I don't often think about what I'm doing as nonfiction or fiction when I'm writing it. Certainly the conversations are recreations of previous conversations. I always just try to stay true to the spirit of them. And I also do try to make them read well and sound well. I just try to write a book that I think is true to the event and that a reader is going to enjoy.
During the years covered in this book, you decide to try to write a book. Before that, were you writing at all?
No. I always read a lot. My entire life I've read a lot, but I wasn't writing at all. I mean, for most of my life I was getting in trouble and being sent away. When I was 25, I didn't have the kind of resume that would get me a job anywhere. So.
And how much of that could you have remembered if you were in a constant fog?
Well, the first book, which takes place in a treatment center, was written using all of my records from the treatment center as a guide, all my medical records, legal records, therapist notes. The second book, I used journals that I did start keeping during that time to use as a guide. And at that point, my memory was sort of back.
The book opens when you're in prison. How did prison compare to rehab?
In certain ways, they're pretty similar. I mean, they're nobody wants to be in either place. They're both pretty boring. They're both occasionally terrifying. Rehab was probably better and worse in a lot of ways. You're in rehab usually by choice, and you usually know if you don't deal with what you need to deal with when you get out, you're going to die. Jail is just like passing time and trying not to get hurt.
And also trying not to do anything that will keep you in it any longer.
Right. I mean, just keep your back to the wall and your mouth closed.
So then the minute you're released, you rush off to Chicago. Why such a hurry?
I had a girlfriend who was living there who was going through troubling times. She was in a halfway house trying to recover from crack addiction. Her grandmother, who was sort of the only person in her life that loved her besides me, had just passed away. And she was just frantic the last time I spoke to her.
And you talk about that in the first book as well. And so I don't know how much I should give away.
We can give it away. I mean, it was given away in the first book. You know, I by the time I got to Chicago, she had killed herself. In the 10 hours between the time I spoke to her and I got there, she hung herself in a shower.
Well, when people are as troubled as some of the people you must have known over the years, does it still come as a shock?
It does come as a shock. It doesn't come as a surprise. I mean, it's still shocking because it hurts so much.
And because you loved her.
And because I loved her and because the loss is so sudden. But I can't say I was surprised. And in certain ways, I respect what she did, and it may have been for the best, as awful as that sounds.
For a long portion of the book, you carry around a bottle of fortified wine, although you're trying to stay sober.
Yeah, I carried a bottle of wine with me for a couple reasons. One was I was always sort of struggling with whether I would go on or not, and I wanted to have, you know, the wine there in case I decided I didn't want to go on. And the other
that was your fallback.
Yeah, that was my fallback. If I hurt too much that I just couldn't deal anymore, I had something to make the hurt go away.
And that's what you say here. You say an addict can't feel what they need to feel, so they use chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, addiction in almost every case I've ever heard of grows out of an inability to deal with emotions. And so addicts or alcoholics find chemicals that make those emotions go away. And, you know, alcohol was one of those chemicals for me, and I kept it close.
Well, how do you recover from that?
I mean, another reason I kept it close was, you know, to teach to build my confidence. I mean, how do you make it go away? You learn over long periods of time to deal with the emotions that you haven't been able to deal with previously. And for me, it was also important to learn to deal with them in the presence of alcohol. You know, alcohol is a part of everyday life. Most people drink. There's alcohol available on every block of every city in America. And I wanted to learn to live with it.
In the first book, you talked about friendships with two men, but here you're focusing on, as the title suggests, one of them, my friend Leonard.
Right. I had two close friends from rehab. One was a judge and one was a gangster. I'm still in good close touch with the judge, and he's still a great friend. But over the immediate years after rehab, I was in much closer contact with the gangster.
And the two of them obviously could not be friends. You were the one in between the two.
I was sort of the connection between them. They actually really liked each other and found that they had a lot in common. But they certainly couldn't have ever had any sort of meaningful relationship.
How do you develop a relationship with a gangster?
I mean, the same as you do with anyone, really. You know, that's one of the things I tried to write about in the book was, in my experience with him and with his friends and his associates, they're real people. You know, they're not sort of these one-dimensional thugs. He had a life and he had interests away from what he did. And
although he is a serious mobster, we're not just talking about some small-time hood here.
No, he was not a small-time hood. I mean, he was at the top of an organization, which if you could get him to talk about, he'd sort of chuckle and say, I was the West Coast director for a large Italian finance firm.
Why you? Was there some reason that he was impressed by you?
The first time we met, he was angry at me for something that I didn't remember. And he just sort of started going off on me, and I threatened him. And I think he was shocked that I threatened him, and I think he actually believed that I'd carry out my threat. And I think that immediately made him respect me.
And then he heard that you'd had some serious dental work without painkillers, and that's the sort of macho thing that might impress a guy like Leonard.
It might have impressed a guy like him. I had dental surgery without painkillers or anesthesia. And then from there, it was, you know, you meet a few people in your life who you just really, really get along with for whatever the reasons. And he was one of those people for me.
Well, he lives very large, extravagant parties, the best steaks, the most beautiful ladies, lavish comfort. So how does someone like that manage in rehab?
I mean, he was just like all the rest of us. You know, one thing about rehab is it sort of equals the playing field or levels the playing field. It doesn't matter how much money you have or don't have or where you're from or what your job is or what your race or religion is. We're all in there because we're damaged and unhealthy, and we all have to deal with the same things.
Many people have remarked that The Sopranos can't be real because one of the characters goes into psychotherapy. But after reading about Leonard, I'm not so sure.
I mean, I sort of think The Sopranos felt much more realistic to me than most other mob-related, you know, television shows or films I've ever seen. I mean, at least it portrays, you know, Tony Soprano as a full person, you know, somebody who has a life and a family and interests outside of what his job is.
Leonard has a bodyguard and hitman-type sidekick who's called Snapper. The two of them are actually kind of sophisticated, and they love art.
Yeah, they were huge fans of art. They loved music. They loved clothing. They loved, you know, food. I mean, like I said, he was a full person who was into a lot of things that didn't have anything to do with earning money illegally or hurting people.
When you went to the Art Institute in Chicago, he actually wept at a Cezanne. I mean, Gauguin.
Edith Gauguin. Yeah. Gauguin was his favorite artist, and he would stand in front of the paintings for literally hours, which was sort of strange. And he would weep. He was very much infatuated with the story of Gauguin's life and how he sort of walked away from a very prosperous career and a family to pursue what he loved.
He gave you money at one point, no questions asked.
He gave me money once, no questions asked, with the condition that I wouldn't spend it on drugs and alcohol, and that I would tell him what it was for when it was the proper time and place.
And you worked for him for a while. Were you able to work for a mobster without committing crimes yourself?
Technically, yeah. You know, technically I was a delivery man, and I didn't ever know what I was delivering. And there was a very specific system under which I worked, which sort of kept information from reaching me.
Well, did you ever know what he really did?
Yeah. I mean, I knew some of it. A lot of it I didn't. I mean, I talk in the book about how he legalized a very large gambling business that was illegal, and he walked me through the process of how it became a legal business. And you know, eventually that became his primary source of income.
So you worked for him, and then you went to Hollywood. How different is life among Chicago mobsters and Hollywood moguls?
Chicago mobsters are much more honest, much more ethical, much more friendly, and if I had to have dinner with one or the other, I'd have dinner with a mobster every time.
Well, you talk about the painful and incredibly personal details about your life here, but you don't confess that one of the screenplays you wrote is the David Schwimmer romantic comedy Kissing a Fool. Was that just too painful to talk about?
Yeah, it actually is, you know. I wrote movies for money, and I can admit that I wrote them for money, but when you do that, you tend to sometimes sacrifice, you know, quality for cash, and that may be a case where that happened.
Well, how do you make the leap from working for a Chicago mobster to writing movies that are potential hits, if not all of them turn out to be?
You know, while I was working for Leonard, I was trying to teach myself how to write, and I couldn't write books, so I tried to write movies, and I wrote a couple, and I finally wrote one that I thought was okay, so I just moved to L.A., and I started meeting people and making phone calls and just trying to hustle, and I was able to, you know, I had a bit of luck, and something sold.
And then you've been writing the screenplay, or did you already write the screenplay for A Million Little Pieces?
Screenplay for A Million Little Pieces is written.
Brad Pitt's supposedly going to star?
Brad Pitt's not starring in it. Brad Pitt is producing it.
Oh, that's nice.
Brad Pitt's producing it with a guy named John Wells, who also makes ER and The West Wing, and they're supposed to start shooting it in the late fall or early summer, and I'm optimistic about it at this point.
And now you're writing fiction as well, aren't you? And a novel of interwoven L.A. stories using the same approach to the language that you did in this book?
I'm writing a book about Los Angeles, sort of multiple protagonists, multiple voices. Some of it will be written the way I write this book and the previous book. Some of it will be written using standard grammar, punctuation, and dialogue attribution just to show people I can do it.
And you've moved to New York.
I live in New York. I live here with my beautiful wife and my beautiful little baby girl, and I love New York City. It's a great place to live.
You couldn't have done this in Los Angeles?
I could have, you know. You know, we actually decided to move to New York after 9/11. We were living in L.A. We saw what happened with 9/11, and we just wanted to come back to New York and you know, try to support it in our own little weird way and be with the people of New York City. And you know, I think we're both, I don't think we'll ever leave.
James Fry's book is My Friend Leonard. It is published by Riverhead Books. Fry, F-R-E-Y. His previous was a New York Times bestseller, A Million Little Pieces, and we look forward to the fiction that's going to be published, I guess, in a couple of years.
I'm looking forward to having it come out. I'm tired of writing books about myself, although I am proud of both of them.